waves crashing and the tide pulls out. It's an angry sea, but there is no doubt that the lighthouse will keep shining out to warm the lonely sailor. And the lightning strikes and the wind cuts cold through the sailor's bones to the sailor's soul, till there's nothing left that he can hold except.
I know it's December, but we're going to talk about weather conditions that can fuel severe storms and tornadoes, and why researchers think climate change could create more big storms in the future. That's the main topic for this week's edition of Jet Streaming. Welcome to the waning days of December. I'm not sure where 2007 went, for goodness sakes. Mark Seely and Craig Edwards are with me, as always. Thank you, gentlemen.
Good to be here, Kathy.
Nice to talk to you again, Kathy.
Likewise. We're going to have to do a special Jet Streaming, I think, you guys, about the year in weather and what a year it was. In the future, Mark and Craig, researchers think we could see even more severe storms. And there is a new study that I'm sure you've seen, just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that indicates global warming could spawn weather conditions that may feed more severe storms and tornadoes by the end of the 21st century. The lead author of that study is meteorologist Jeff Trapp from Purdue University, and we're pleased that Professor Trapp is with us on Jet Streaming. Welcome, Jeff.
Welcome. Thanks.
Now, yours is the second such study predicting more severe weather. The first was released by NASA this past August. What are we to make of both of these studies?
Well, the results are relatively consistent in that they're both showing some effect of increases in greenhouse gases on severe thunderstorms.
And Jeff, I wanted to ask a little bit more detail about the study. Water vapor, as a feedback mechanism, of course, is alluded to in many of the climate change research studies. And, of course, the latent energy that's included when you incorporate water vapor is a huge component of the climate system, much greater potential there than what the other greenhouse gas constituents convey. But in your study, you highlighted the fact that the water vapor signal in the global climate models is going to override any potential diminishment of the wind as far as fuel for the development of severe storms. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. There's two basic ingredients that we look at, and in fact that weather forecasters look at on a daily basis to try to assess severe thunderstorms. One of them is what we're calling storm energy. It's more explicitly called convective available potential energy, but it's linked highly to the low-level water vapor, and that increases in the future. We also see a decrease in wind shear, and the wind shear is just the change of wind speed and direction with distance from the ground, and we see a decrease in the wind shear. And the wind shear, by the way, is what makes storms rotate, and that can lead to tornadoes.
This is Craig Edwards. I'm old enough to remember the Palm Sunday outbreak of 1965 and also the super outbreak of 74. And I was in Indiana on June 2nd, 1990, when we had something like 40 tornadoes on one day. And so now all of this has occurred way back years ago. So can you really say that there's going to be more frequency or more intensity to these storms after what we've experienced for the last 50 years? There's certainly been enough severe storms. I'm just wondering if there's not more people looking for problems and more people to be in the path of these severe storms.
Well, that's right. You raise a really interesting issue, and I'll point out that one of the things that we did not use in this study is the observational record of tornadoes. That's based on, as you mentioned, eyewitness reports. And if you look at the trend in eyewitness reporting, it's increasing. And as you say, it's by and large due to increases in the number of people that are looking for storms. And that's why we use climate models for the study.
Jeff, did you run into limitations, though, with the climate models that could affect your results? Could it be even worse, maybe, than you think?
Yeah, it could. One of the things that we tried to do is compare the climate models as the model simulates the current atmosphere to observations. And one of the suggestions in this comparison is that we're underestimating the number of days that are conducive to severe storms currently, which could mean that we're also underestimating the number of days in the future as well.
Jeff, in terms of teasing out some of the geographic detail, I was wondering, many of the IPCC-related research reports have alluded to a northern displacement of the polar jet stream. Ben Sanders' work at Lawrence Livermore has also alluded to an increase in the depth of the troposphere. And I was wondering, does this mean we might see more severe storm development at higher latitude positions, or is that inferred by any of the models?
Well, that was one of the things that we were wondering if we would see in our results. And in fact, we don't. And this is something that we'll address in a follow-up study. But yeah, as you say, one of the things that the climate model projections allude to is a northward shift in the storm track. And one of the effects that this has is storms that are farther north displaced from sources of moisture like the Gulf of Mexico. And I think that's one of the reasons why we don't see as large of an increase in severe frequency in the northern latitudes as we do in the southern regions, like in the southeast U.S.
So that proximity to a source of water vapor, at least from the model standpoint, is a real critical feature then.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why we see increases along the Gulf Coast states as well as the Atlantic coastal regions, especially during the summer, where they see a more increase in evaporation and an increase in the transport of this evaporated water inland.
One of the things that's been most notable to me since my years in Minnesota is the startup of the tornado season. I remember not long ago, I think it was 1998, we had a tornado outbreak at the end of March, which was the St. Peter's tornado. But we also have had tornadoes that have now extended into September. So here, up here in Minnesota, we've actually had a tornado seasons that run from March to September, which I think is a noticeable change in the severe weather conditions over the past 15 years or so.
And this is another thing that we thought we might see, and that's a shift in the season, so that we would see a higher frequency of storms in the future in the fall months. We don't see that. That's not a signal that we see in the climate models, but there are some biases in the models that we're still trying to address and still trying to figure out and determine what their effects are.
Mm. Could you give us an example just briefly?
Well, sure. Yeah, there's a pretty well-known bias in climate models in the southern Great Plains. So that regions of including, the say, Texas Panhandle, Oklahoma Panhandle, those tend to be drier and warmer than observed. And this dry, warm bias enhances in the future. And so that's one of the reasons why we tend not to see a really strong signal in those parts of the country in the latter months of the year.
And Jeff, one more piece of observational evidence similar to what Craig Edwards referred to. Back in October of 2005, we had a nasty flash flood in east central Minnesota. In fact, arguably the worst or close to the worst we've ever observed in the month of October. Awful lot of Cape energy, I think, was represented in that storm, that variable you referred to that you studied. I'm wondering if this isn't a sign also of how the climate is changing, that we might see the development of the more intense thunderstorms linger deeper into the fall season as well.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. And as you say, it's a lot of this is related to this available energy that's called CAPE. And if the moisture source, the Gulf of Mexico, as an example, stays open and allows moisture to be transported far inland, then that's certainly a possibility.
And finally, Jeff, where do you want to take your research?
Right. Well, one of the limitations that we have by using climate models is that we can't explicitly resolve thunderstorms. Imagine an interstate highway with cities spaced every, say, 30 miles, and a thunderstorm that has a diameter of several miles go undetected between those two cities. And so what we're trying to do now is to use higher resolution models that can explicitly resolve thunderstorms so that we can start to say something then explicit about the types of storms that we see, whether or not these storms are likely to be to be producing tornadoes and get a better handle of their intensity as well.
We'll be looking forward to your next study when it comes out. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Professor Jeff Trapp. He's from Purdue University.
Sleigh bells ring. Are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland.
Last week we talked with the author of the book, The Snowflake, and it is a beautiful book about snowflakes with some stunning photos. Our next guest takes extraordinary photos in all seasons, but we want to talk with him about winter photography. He is Jim Brandenburg, a Minnesota-based photographer. His gallery is in Ely, Minnesota, and for listeners who are not familiar with Jim, check him out on the web. His work is incredible. Where did we find you today, Jim?
Well, Kathy, I'm on the north shore of Lake Superior. In fact, the waves are quiet today, but if you listen carefully, maybe you can hear them slapping against the ice.
Oh, I love that
north
sound.
North of Duluth.
Ah, I love that sound. Have you been out playing in the snow?
Well, I love the snow. I just got back from the Alps, actually. I came back from 6 weeks in France, and I was listening to all the weather forecasts in France trying to figure out when it was going to snow. I needed some snow for the pictures I was shooting, So this is the perfect top topic, photography and weather. I can't think of two things that work better together.
Really, because as a kind of an amateur, very bad photographer, I find I have a horrible time when I go out and take pictures. Tell me a little bit about the challenges of winter photography.
Well, I think the challenge of winter photography used to be with the cameras. Now with the new technology, it's just incredible. The cameras are smarter than we are, Kathy, so the digital revolution has changed our lives in the world of photography for several reasons. But I think people are afraid of getting cold. I think that's the first thing. And it always surprised me, even Minnesotans sometimes, unless you're really into the outdoors and you deal with it all the time, people have this fear of getting cold. And when I go out and watch people shooting, they usually have too many clothes on and they get too sweaty and then they get uncomfortable and they get chilled. So they want to be comfortable. But winter opens up a lot of opportunities for photography. There's no question about that. And Minnesotans certainly have all these wonderful seasons. It's like traveling around the world, in a sense.
Mm.
Jim, Mark Seeley here. I'm not much of a photographer myself, but I can't help but wonder, in terms of the light, now we all know there's less light in the winter season, and the sun angle is vastly different, of course modified greatly by if you have presence of snow. But is the quality of the light a little bit different in the winter as well?
Well, yes, Mark. The quality of light, to me, is a lot nicer. If you go through the pages of, say, National Geographic, where I spent most of my career, you'll find that a lot of the photographs, especially the landscapes, are shot, at sunrise and sunset. The human psyche tends to respond to that low, warm light. And, of course, we have this wonderful, not much of it, of course, in the winter, and it's shorter. Up in Ely sometime, I guess pretty soon now, we'll be getting sunsets around 4:30 or so. In the summertime, unfortunately, it means you have to, at sunrise, you have to get up like 3 to get to the place you want to shoot. But the winter, I think the winter is my favorite time to shoot, partly because of the light, the low quality, the low angle, and the quality of light gives us kind of a warm glow. And the simplicity of the landscape, the snow simplifies that complex, all the clutter that you tend to get in nature sometimes of all the trees and the bushes and anything else that's in the scene. Sometimes the snow can simplify it and turn it into a wonderful graphic display. Some of my favorite photographs were shot in the wintertime.
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes,
well, this is
especially when I worked in the high Arctic up with the white wolves, where everything was white. I mean, there was virtually nothing there but the black nose and the eyeballs of a wolf. Everything is pure white. And I'd also have to say what surprises so many people is my favorite time to shoot is during kind of a heavy snowfall or a blizzard on the prairie. It seems to be more magical.
Yeah, I noticed, this is Craig Edwards, I noticed that after we had a recent snowfall here, the brilliance of the diamond-like character of the snow, and like you say, the tranquility and the subtleness of just some of the browns and the evergreens and the snow sitting softly on the branches of these pine and the evergreen trees. It was just beautiful. And I think people need to take time and visualize those things and sort of like enjoy the essence of nature in the winter season, which we tend to be rushing around, like you say, bundled up from the cold and just rushing from the car to the store and back into the house and those types of things.
Yeah, and I think having just driven up from the cities just this morning and driven through Duluth, sometimes I was dismayed at how dark the snow is in the city, and just getting out in the country where it's so pure and beautiful. Sometimes, whoops, I almost slipped there. Sometimes we forget how pure and beautiful the winters can be when we spend so much time in the city in the winter. And it can be kind of downright ugly almost when that snow turns gray and black and dark and salty.
Yeah.
But winter is a wonderful opportunity to shoot. The small cameras now fit in your pockets. So you keep them warm. And it's a good excuse to be out. It's a good excuse to get outside, is go out and shoot some great photographs. And the cameras and the exposures are all automatic, and it can kind of figure out that it needs to be a certain kind of an exposure. And your opportunities have greatly expanded with the new technologies.
I got to ask you about a comment you made, Jim, about shooting in heavy snow. It seems a little counterintuitive to me because I do video, and boy, shooting in video is not exactly real conducive in heavy snowfall. So why do you think it's interesting for you as a photographer to sometimes shoot in heavy snow?
Well, it's very evocative. There's something about a beautiful snowfall. And, of course, the subject is important. You just don't shoot the snow falling, but if you've got some beautiful conifer trees, or if you're working with an animal like a wolf or a moose, it adds a certain kind of a mystique. There's something that it's like a beautiful fog or a... It's very emotional to me. I rarely go out in the middle of the day when the sun is shining bright. It adds all kinds of problems. Psychologically, we think that we need more light and bright light for pictures, but the human mind seems to be more, it's like poetry, I suppose. Sometimes it's oftentimes the dark stuff, the moody stuff, that tends to grab people's attention. It isn't always the bright, cheerful, happy, but it's that, I don't know what it is about snow, the snowfall. It has always attracted me since I was a little boy. I'd love to be out in the snow shooting. It's not always good for the cameras, but it's a wonderful time to shoot. It separates all the extraneous materials again around, all the distractions. You can isolate things. Say if you're photographing a moose and the snow falls falling on its back and the antlers, and there's something, even look at the wildlife paintings, the people that, of course, Minnesota is known for that. Look at all the numbers of paintings that are shot or painted in the snow, and especially even while it's snow is falling. There's just something about that, and I can't quite explain it. Maybe you folks can.
See, Jim, the emotional side of photography, that is in the composition as well as the subject, I'm just wondering, in winter, do you take most of your shots in a handheld mode, or are you actually using a tripod? Do you have to have your eye really looking through? Is that an important dimension to you?
Well, the wildlife is what really drives me. I love landscapes, but I've kind of specialized in my life of tracking wolves down and making wolf movies and wolf pictures. And so I rarely use a tripod unless it's an extremely long lens. And now I've been shooting a lot of HD video, so you have to use a tripod. But I prefer no tripod. And again, with the new cameras, you don't really need tripods unless you're shooting in extremely low light, because the ISO numbers, in other words, the receptive speed of the chip is so much faster and so much higher quality, and it simplifies things so much. So you don't really need a tripod unless you're shooting in extremely dark situations, or, say, in the night, photographing the northern lights or the sky somehow.
Mm. Mm. You know, I know you were just in the Alps, and I'm really curious. What wintertime scene have you always wanted to capture and haven't done so?
Well, I've been very lucky, Cassie. I've been to the high Arctic, and I haven't been to Antarctica. I've never, for some reason, haven't been particularly interested in going down there, I think because they don't have mammals, so to speak. But I am trying to find wolves in Europe now. that's the real challenge. You can count them on almost one hand, the number of wolves you find in France right now. So I've got a fantasy picture of wolves, a pack of wolves going single file over a pass in the Alps, in the French Alps, coming up from Italy or where they just come from. And the snow's falling a little bit. You can see maybe the Matterhorn in the background, just kind of basically through the elusive, foggy snowfall. That's kind of a fantasy picture. Sometimes you have to paint those pictures in your mind to go after and seek them out.
I hope you find that picture. Jim, all the best to you. Thanks for joining us.
Well, Kathy, thank you, folks.
Oh, I appreciate your time. That's Jim Brandenburg, outdoor and nature photographer extraordinaire based in Ely, Minnesota. If you'd like to see his images online, do so. It's jimbrandenburg.com. And while we're on the topic of websites, it's time for the weather website of the week. Craig Edwards, it is your turn.
Well, Kathy, when you start feeling that it's pretty cold where you're at, you might want to take a look at the Mount Washington observation. So I'm going to suggest the Mount Washington, all one word, mountwashington.org/weather. So you can check out the wind chill reading in Mount Washington in the Northeast this winter.
Well, all right. That'll make us feel really good. Thanks. Time to wrap this up. Thanks, Craig. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks, Kathy.
And thanks to all of you for listening. It is so nice to hear from you. Do drop us a line at minnesotapublicradio.org. By the way, Happy New Year! And in 2008, remember to keep your eyes on the sky.
Keep on.